duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Welcome to the show, people. I'm drinking my drink, I'm smoking my smoke, and today is going to be a great show. I talk a lot about life after capitalism, the enslavement of the monetary system, and how we can break the spell, and my personal favorite of these new models is the resource-based economy. My guest today, Jay Sable, is the head of an organization called One Community, which focuses on creating small-scale sustainable models and test cities, rather than just talking and waiting for the entire globe to get on board, which I think is the way to go. So I'm psyched that Jay is here, and he's doing it right, and he's willing to come on my stupid stoner show and talk about it. I'm also pleased as fuck to introduce my co-host today, Michael Nelson. He's a bona fide pimp behind Midwest Real. That's another podcast out there. Mike was kind enough to have me on as a guest last month on his show, and I knew I had this show coming up, so I thought Mr. Nelson here would be a great choice to keep me company. Mike, how you doing?
Good man. Mr. Nelson, that makes me think of my dad.
Well, I'm glad you're here because I know that you had seen this post I made last week. And as a fellow podcaster, I wanted to talk to you about it and see what you thought, because I'm talking about that donations giveaway thing. So for anyone who is not clued in, I've been trying to think of creative ways to monetize the show. And I've had this idea that at the end of every month, I take a good chunk of the donations I get, maybe half, and gift that to a listener. What do you think of that? Is that too close to a raffle or a lottery? Am I dealing with legal grounds here?
I don't know, man. I think I mentioned to you in the little stream of comments that I know there are, you know, you might have to watch out tax-wise with that. I'm not really sure exactly what the rules are. I'm sure somebody out there can answer that a lot better than I can. But it's a creative idea for sure, and it also gives back to your listeners a little bit in a way that most, I don't think any podcast I know of does that. So,
well, right. I mean, I'd like to, instead of just talking about conspiracies and what's shitty, like, I would really enjoy making a positive contribution to individual lives, but I don't have the resources. And I mean, I don't get a ton of donations now, but with this huge audience we're working with at this point, I think maybe it would prompt more donations to have something like this going on. Because right now I get maybe like $100 a month, and it's not good. But if just a fraction of the audience, say 1,000 people, donated $5 a month, not always the same 1,000 people, but like an average, if I gave away half of that, that's $2,500. And that's great. And that's also the amount that I make at my day job. So I could quit that and be able to go down a list of PayPal donators and randomly pick someone and send them $2,500. That'd be awesome. And
I like quitting your day job's always good, man.
Yeah. I know you had Matt Skaggs on from Disinfo recently. He's a bit of an inspiration in that department. Although he seems to be, he's very modest, and maybe he's a little just worried about his situation. But he seems way further along the path than I am, and I'm willing to quit.
Yeah, he's pretty well established. I mean, he's been kind of doing his thing online for a while now. I kind of asked him about his background on our most recent podcast, and you know, he kind of just went through how he eventually hooked up with Disinfo, the Disinfo cast, how he was able to finally quit his day job. And it wasn't something that came quickly for him. I mean, it was just, you know, as you know, you just make connection after connection doing something like this. And you know, an opportunity cropped up that he went after, and you know, he knew the guys that ran Disinfo, and it just worked out for him. So between that and, you know, his relationship with the Joe Rogan Experience and all the other people he knows, it was just kind of one of those things that eventually materialized for him. So
yeah, I mean, David Seaman's another one of those guys. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right on. Well, he's been on my show talking about Bitcoin. You know, has his own David Seaman Hour. He's a little more of a conventional journalist, like in a good way. You know, he's definitely, he's in between where I am and the mainstream is, which is anywhere in there in that spectrum I'm happy with. But he got this morning show crowdfunded called Rise. He's going to be moving to LA, taking the giant leap, and
That's
starting
awesome.
This morning show. Yeah, it's pretty pretty sick. I mean, his audience raised $7,500, and now this is his new reality, waking up, doing this morning show that streams live on the internet, and living in LA. Like, that's pretty fucking cool. I mean, I've talked to him a couple times. I'm probably going to be taking trips up to LA to do that show once in a while.
That's awesome. But,
yeah, I mean, it's sick. There's a lot of stuff happening in this podcasting space, and I'm happy to be a part of it, even if I'm like one of the most fringe people involved. I actually think that's a good thing. I take pride in that.
Yeah, it's all, you know, it's really all about doing something, going after it, and then meeting other people that are doing the same thing, because eventually something's going to work out for somebody, you know. And if you've already established a relationship with that person, they're going to want to help you out if they know you're legit and they know what you're doing is really, you know, coming from your heart and coming from the standpoint of wanting to, you know, influence positive change. You know, that's really what it's all about.
True.
Amen.
In other news, something else I wanted to share with the people before we bring Jay in. I mean, you sent me this article about the Norwegian University of Science and Technology's Department of Neuroscience. I clearly just recalled that off the top of my head, but they used data from a U.S. National Health Survey of 2,200 people to see what association there was, if any, between psychedelic drug use and mental health problems. They found no links to mental health problems, addiction, or negative effects on long-term health. So I guess, you know, when people take too many mushrooms, it just feels like you're going to die. Don't worry. You're all right.
I've even seen, too, I just shared something this morning about psilocybin actually regrowing brain cells, I believe, which was, you know, that's like another step, which I never foresaw, you know. It's pretty crazy. Like, it just seems like more and more data keeps coming out in favor of some kind of responsible psychedelic use or inner exploration via psychedelics. Yeah. It's really shocking.
Well, as much as I love the psychedelics, the mind-expanding drugs, I really love ecstasy. And I don't know that it's necessarily mind-expanding, but it definitely can help couples. I mean, in my own experience, not that me and my girlfriend have problems, but you take ecstasy and you just start unloading all this stuff, like all that, you just go into such detail, and it's always positive. It's always with a positive, like a positive atmosphere around it. It's a really awesome drug, and there's also physical effects that feel very euphoric and great. I don't know if you have any experience with ecstasy.
I don't personally, but I did do some research about MDMA, which is, you know, the main ingredient in ecstasy. And, you know, there's all these clinical trials now that like MAPS have been doing, and they've shown that it literally can cure PTSD, and if not cure it, treat it. And everybody involved in their clinical trials, whether they were, I believe it was something ridiculous, like 80-some% of people were actually cured of PTSD. And everybody who wasn't cured said that it had a positive influence on their condition. So yeah. I found that to be unbelievably enlightening.
Well, I believe that it could treat PTSD because it forces you to open up your emotions. Like, I find myself saying strings of words that I'm like, yeah, I do think this. I never thought I would say it. You know, it's not a big deal, but here you go. And I can imagine that someone who's dealing with some traumatic shit they did overseas is, it just pours out of them. And it's a great feeling. That alone feels great. And then you top it with chemicals that make you feel positive and euphoric, and you're going to have a good time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did find this article, and it says psilocybin mushrooms promote growth of new brain cells, and here we go, can even cure PTSD and depression.
It's fucked up. I mean, when you look at someone on mushrooms or acid and you're sober, they look like they're doing damage to themselves, you know? you look at them and you're like, there's no way this person's coming back 100%. 99.9, sure. It just looks off-putting to the sober mind, to the sober eye. But I guess we're finding that it's not as damaging as people once thought, which is great, because if there was really insight to be gained from it, if you're in the Terrence McKenna camp who thinks that these spores might be communication, a form of communication biologically from another species or another multidimensional being, there'd have to be, if there's really all this positivity to be gained from it, it couldn't really be doing harm, you know? or it shouldn't be doing harm.
Yeah, and I kind of have a theory on that, because I remember learning a while back that the way it actually interacts with your brain is kind of by shutting filters down or dampening filters or parts of the brain. So you're actually getting into a more basic mode of operation cognitively. So it may seem like the person is kind of, you know, shutting down or really augmenting their consciousness in a way that could be damaging, but it's all just a function of how it's interacting with the brain temporarily. So it seems like, you know, all the data about cannabis and, you know, like we mentioned with MDMA and psilocybin, it seems like they all psychedelics kind of act in a similar manner on the brain as far as doing that. And it seems to be something that's temporary, not long term.
Yeah, I mean, I can get behind that, because it's a cliche of the stoner, you know, you're talking to them and they just look over and say, "What?" And that's a huge cliche, but internally, and I can't speak for everyone, but internally, a lot of times if I'm in that state, there are thoughts coursing through my mind like fucking greyhounds on a racetrack. And it's because of that that I'm not paying attention to what's going on externally. So that hazy "what" is really just, that's because you've distracted me from my own train of thoughts that I wasn't going to be on without this chemical help.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, too much of anything is going to influence you in a way that kind of inhibits your ability to function. You know, I could go in my kitchen and eat too much spinach and I'd have a tummy ache, you know? Yeah. Like,
I have a friend who was trying to pass a drug test and he overdosed on water.
That's insane, man.
Yeah, he got water poisoning.
Yeah, so I mean, it just goes to show you, you know, it's just because something, you know, can kind of inhibit you, or can maybe not inhibit, but limit your ability to express yourself and function, that does not mean you're doing any type of long-term damage to yourself or any damage that is going to like affect you down the road.
Agreed, man. And it's good to find people that have that thought process, because growing up, they just were few and far between. But the internet's a great thing, connects people. And we're about to get connected with Jay right now, because I'm about to call him. It is about that time. He's probably waiting. But before I do dial him in, I have to throw out this short ad for Conspiratees. It's my conspiracy clothing brand. It's how I bring in the dollars from doing the show, and it's good fun. And I've never had anyone not like what they bought. So check them out. Help me keep the lights on, and we'll be talking positive things on the other side with Jay Sable.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the Brave Roof tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. We have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiratees as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiratees redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiratees.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
Folks, Mike and I are back, and we're here with the entrepreneur and visionary Jay Sable, who is the executive director and community building expert for One Community, a nonprofit organization that pushes for the adoption of a sustainable resource economy model, primarily by providing open source plans and creating test cities and working living models that show people what's possible within this type of lifestyle. And this is a topic I'm very much interested in and thrilled to explore. So Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Man, I'm sure, like, I know a ton of my listeners have seen Zeitgeist movies and are familiar with the Venus Project. We've had Jacques Fresco on a few months ago as well. But since you're the expert, why don't you tell us about the resource-based economy model from your perspective and where One Community fits in? Because I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, a resource-based economy is just one aspect of one community. So if I were just to focus on the resource-based economy as maybe a metaphor for the project as a whole, you know, the concept is the idea that we are more successful and more effective when we work together, when we share and when we collaborate and cooperate versus when we compete with each other. And so using that as a metaphor for the whole model, one community is a macrocosm of that microcosm. You know, the idea is to apply that concept to all aspects of living, everything from food, energy, housing, to social architecture, recreation, educational models, and put that all out there as open source and free shared blueprints and content so that people can duplicate it. And we can create a global archive and a global think tank and collaborative of people working together to create a better world for everybody.
I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer. It's a shame that we've gone so many thousands of years without working on this type of society. For people who, I guess, are familiar with the Venus Project and, you know, the resource-based economy, you said it's only a part of it. So where does one community differ from that?
I think that nobody's ever asked me that question. Looking at the Venus Project, so the Venus Project, my perspective on the Venus Project is this complete overhaul and revolution of the way that we think about living. And so one community is definitely that, you know, this, we consider ourselves a stepping stone towards the Venus Project. And so I guess maybe there's not really a difference. It's more focusing on that stepping stone, like what's necessary to gain the mainstream support and interest in what it is that we're doing, and to provide enough value to an individual to take what they're doing right now, which in most cases really isn't working for a lot of people, but they don't have another alternative. And in the case of the Venus Project, it's such a grand vision and such an amazing thing that people don't really know where to even start. And so one community is that we see ourselves as that path, as a viable option that average people with average means can apply in their life right now and start putting these concepts to use and moving in the direction that they want to move, you know, and on the smallest scale being all the individual components, food, energy, housing, things that normal people can apply in their life and start implementing, maybe building a natural swimming pool or maybe just building a guest house, all the way up to the larger vision, the idea of building complete self-sufficient, self-sustainable and self-replicating teacher demonstration villages, communities and cities as that stepping stone to the much larger vision of, okay, let's revolutionize the world. What does that look like? And so I'm not sure if that answered your question, but I think that's kind of the distinguishing feature where we see ourselves right now and the ultimate grand vision of where we as a species believe we can go, what we're capable of.
Absolutely, man, because one of the biggest criticisms of the Venus Project and the Zeitgeist movement is that it is so grand in scale that you just have to wait. Like, they focus so much on education and, you know, to some extent marketing, and meanwhile I'm going to a 9-to-5 job every day wondering, you know, no one I speak with an entire day even knows what the Venus Project is. So I'm like, in my lifetime would we ever even see progress in this direction? So I love that you're working on a much smaller scale and building. Like, I heard an interview with you on another show, and you were just about to buy some land, I believe. Have you done that yet?
We're still seeking funding for the land. You know, we put 2.5 years into it, and that would be the next huge step for our project, is acquiring the land, because that would allow us to take the open source blueprinting and all the projects and everything that we're doing to the next level.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about how it's grown, because I know you've done years and years of research and trying to find the most efficient and cost-effective ways of doing the things we need to do in our daily lives. And let's bring us up to speed on how the organization is formed and the part of the process you're in right now.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it's been, for me personally, it's been a 17, 18 year process. This became a full-time job for me. Well, not really a job because I'm not paid, but it became a full-time endeavor for me. I quit my job. I sold my business and basically said, okay, this is what I'm going to do until I succeed, until we set it up. And then this is the lifestyle I want to live for the rest of my life, about 2.5 years ago. And that was in identifying the property. You know, we looked for 2 years for the perfect property. And because our organization is all about sharing and really inviting the world to participate, that created a unique set of criteria for identifying the perfect location. You know, we need a location that's close to a major airport. We need easy access. It needs to be a location that's beautiful so that people want to actually come and visit it while we're building, not waiting 5 years for the infrastructure to be in place, like an eco resort or something like that.
Right.
And so when we finally identified that property after looking over four or five different states at just a multitude of different properties, that's when I leapt, you know, I'm like, okay, it's time to do this full time. And so we put together our website and everything, that all the research and the work that had been done behind the scenes, and finally said, okay, let's create a public face for this. And we started calling in the team. And that's another one of those things that really distinguishes our project from what I've seen from the other projects that are out there, is nobody on our team other than my wife knew each other before this project was launched. And interestingly enough, everybody on the team has pretty much the same story as everybody else, which is, man, we've wanted this. We've talked to our friends, and you know, everybody thinks it's a really great idea, but finding people that are really taking action is a whole nother story. And so then when we all ran into each other, we're like, oh my God, we're creating this, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've been doing for the last 2.5 years, is becoming shovel ready. You know, it's a it's an immense amount of work. There's my experience is that there's this dreamy notion of, you know, okay, let's just build sustainable cities. And it's like, wait a minute, there's, you know, there's counties to deal with, there's code to deal with, you need 3D renderings, you need CAD, need engineering, electrical, plumbing, you know, all this different stuff. So the idea is the first step, but now creating the open source blueprints and actually really creating the infrastructure and the details necessary before you can even build, I mean, that's the bulk of it. And that's why we believe, and why our whole intent of our nonprofit organization is to provide that for people. Because if we can provide that for people, we really believe something like this is just humanity is primed for exponential growth of this concept of jumping on board and going, man, let's launch these things all over the world. But we got to define it. I mean, that's my perspective on it, is that our goal is to define how much it costs, what your time investment is going to be, and what it's going to look like when you're done. So you have a clear idea of an expectation so that people are motivated to achieve that and they know what their investment is going to be, and then people can jump on board. And so that's what we're all about, and that's what we're focused on.
Nice.
So speaking of jumping on board, that's actually kind of what I wanted to ask you. So if somebody isn't local to your, you know, your physical project and what you guys are actually doing with your hands on a day-to-day basis, what can just a normal person that wants to help you guys out actually do at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the way that we're organizing is virtually. You know, our team members are spread out all over the country and in a couple cases outside of the country. So, and on top of that, we also, for people that might not be interested in moving onto the property, we have a satellite member option, which is for people that really want to participate in every aspect of one community with the idea that they're going to start their own version of this somewhere else. And they can call that whatever they want, but they want to be in the nitty gritty and participating in our weekly calls and our whole back office and all the Google Docs and everything that we use to collaborate and create everything that we're creating. And so we have that. And then same thing for international folks that might have visa issues. We have a new visa issue possibility that we've explored that might open up an educational visa for people as well. And so, you know, the short answer is where everything that we do, we're organizing virtually. You know, the time when we get together is for our consensus trainings. But other than that, you know, anybody can participate in one community from anywhere in the world.
That's awesome, man. And I want to back up a bit, because you mentioned, I know you don't want to disclose exactly where the property is if you haven't bought it yet. That makes total sense. But you mentioned which state it was in. So I assume we're talking about something in the United States.
Yeah.
Aren't there huge roadblocks and regulations you have to deal with when creating a structure like this from within the U.S.?
Totally. Which is, and you know, so silver lining to the reality of that situation is that's a big part of our open source purpose. You know, so we've spent the last couple of years building the relationship with our county and really, really getting clear with them that our goal is to expand the international building code. We're not trying to circumvent it. We're trying to really understand why those rules were put in place, because they were there to protect people, mostly from themselves, in our opinion. And then to say, okay, if we understand your criteria for creating the code, then if we can meet those criteria in a new and sustainable way, will you help us to rewrite it essentially and be a demonstration county that supports these ideas and then helps us spread this to other counties? And so the good news about all that is, you know, this is what we think that it's essential that mainstream money get behind this idea. And mainstream money is in developed nations predominantly. I think most people would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And developed nations are using the International Building Code. So it would be way easier for us to build something like this in Brazil or Haiti or anywhere else that doesn't have those codes, which is great for the idea spreading. But for the concept of sharing what it is that we're doing and open sourcing everything so that it's maximally duplicable, it really, really makes sense to operate within those confines. And I'll take it even a step further. You know, we're doing everything we can. One community won't be located in California, but we're doing everything we can to build the California commercial code, because that will create maximum duplicability.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the strictest code probably in the States is B California's, I'd assume.
And that's why we're going there. And nice. We probably won't be zoned. It's looking like we won't have to be zoned commercial, but a lot of people will. And so, you know, the story of our life is doing everything the hard way, but the payoff in the long term for humanity is obvious.
I was doing some research for this interview, and I was listening to another show you did, and you were talking about kind of similar systemic and logistical issues and how you have to deal with funding and how you have to deal with different bureaucratic roadblocks and whatever. And I just couldn't, the irony kind of struck me that you guys are actually trying to eventually transcend that and transcend this system, but right now you're totally beholden to this system and you have to operate within it. So yep. do you see a point where you're going to have to kind of break away from that and be like, look, for us to get where we want to go, we're going to have to actually start operating outside of the box a little more and not rely on those traditional power structures? Or do you think it's going to have to be kind of a long-term give and take for you guys to get where you want to go?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both. You know, from an internal perspective, we're all about transcending that and creating something new. But from an external and collaborative, cooperative perspective, the reality of it is we want to work as closely with our local counties and our state officials as we possibly can, because if we can get those folks on board and we can start really educating and opening their eyes, then that makes it easier for everybody. And we, you know, the big quote that we have on our website is the Buckminster Fuller quote. You know, it says, in order to change an existing paradigm, you do not struggle to try and change the problematic model, but you create a new model and make the old one obsolete. That, in essence, is this higher service to which we're all being called. That's our real focus, is like, hey, we want to demonstrate a better way. And at the same time, you know, we're not interested in pushing against anybody. You know, it's not a battle for us. We're not struggling against anybody. We're all on the same team here. And so, you know, when we look at county officials and code and regulation, we just look at that as part of the process. Like, okay, we understand it's been put in place for a reason. How can we work with that? How can we expand it? We believe there's a win for everybody, you know, and so our goal is to really embrace the process. And, you know, we've learned through experience that that's what we're here to do.
Right on, man. I mean, it all sounds awesome. We've been a bit vague so far about the actual community. Can you give the listeners a bit of an overview about what you project for this community? Why is this better? Why is this worth working towards instead of what we have now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the physical infrastructure, well, so the general overview of the concept, the idea of why it would be better just for, you know, the average Joe that might be working a 9-to-5, is that when you build sustainable infrastructure, you reduce the predominant costs in most people's life. You know, you can eliminate your housing bills, you can eliminate your electricity bills, and you can eliminate your food bills, and we're building an education program too so that you can eliminate your education bills as well. If you get rid of those things, man, people, that frees up a lot of resources. And we're moving as a species, we're moving into more of a virtual world. You know, more labor-based jobs are going away, a lot more home-based jobs are opening up, and our entire model is designed to function as a community model where the community itself is the revenue producing stream, you know, until we reach some point like Jacques Fresco envisions, where we no longer need money. You know, the reality of it is we see that we still need money, and so for people that want to get out of debt, for people that want to, you know, buy the things that they want to buy that they can't create themselves, which is a lot, almost everything, you know, there's a revenue stream built into everything that we're doing, which is sharing the model itself. And the more you share the model, the more successful you are, and the more people can duplicate the model, because everything necessary to duplicate it from a blueprint standpoint is for free. And so the idea is by teaching people how to build the sustainable infrastructure and by setting up the infrastructure to create this self-sufficiency or near self-sufficiency with a business model to go along with it, people have more free time to do the things that they want to do, and they'll have more money to do the things that they want to do. You know, they've eliminated their commute. They're working in more of a collaborative, cooperative environment that is a model that's already working in large families and already working in less civilized, quote unquote, nations where people are working together as large groups to maintain themselves. And so we want to create a model that takes that and shows that to, you know, mainstream America, mainstream Canada, mainstream Europe. You know, what does this look like? Then how do you do this, and what are the individual benefits? And that those are the predominant benefits are more time to do the things that you want to do, surrounded by people that are on the same page with you, and more money to do the things that you want to do because your overhead is so dramatically low. And then applying the idea of working together and collaborating, you can create an environment that is also superior from a tangible perspective. And that's where it gets to the resource-based economy and the idea that, hey, if we're all working together and we're in close proximity, we don't all need a car. We just need access to a car whenever we want one. We don't all need a boat. Right. Just need access to a boat whenever we want one. We don't need a power drill. We don't need a microwave. We don't need an individual refrigerator. As long as we have access to all that stuff, we don't have to invest our resources in owning 100 of them for 100 people. We can identify exactly how many we need, so we're never short on what we need, and apply those resources then to expanding the things that we have access to. And so, you know, it just works. You know, it works.
That kind of brings me back to something that I mentioned before we were rolling about how right now everything is relative to the system that we're in. And what I mean by that is we've all existed in this capitalistic system where we own everything. Like, I have my own car, I have my own TV, I have my own this or that. And I kind of think that we're really going to need to break away from that. We're really going to need a generation at least to kind of purge ourselves of those ideas, because how can you take a person from the system that we're in right now, where everybody owns their own thing, and have them go into something that's communal where they don't own their own thing without holding on to a vestige of wanting to have ownership over something?
Well said. Yeah. Well, and that's, so we talk about our organization as a bridge between pragmatism and idealism, you know, that we're building that bridge. And the pragmatic aspect is, you know, people have debt, you know, and people want to own things, you know. And so we've built our model to address that and say, okay, we've got an entrepreneurial model and a lot of opportunities to really capitalize on the existing system and the benefits that it offers, while simultaneously transcending the negative aspects of it, the debtor society and the things that really put people under a thumb that they can't get out from underneath of. The whole model solves that issue. But I completely agree with you, you know. And so we would like to believe that this is the stepping stone to what you're describing, is A, going to create that generation of people that have grown up in this environment, in these sustainable and self-sufficient communities, and simultaneously for the folks that are already in this capitalist system, to provide an environment that allows them to live for the highest good of all. And that's a big tagline and a big part of our project and our guiding philosophy, is how do we make decisions for the highest good of all? And our belief is that the number one barrier to people making decisions for the highest good of all, because we believe that humanity as a whole, we're good people. We want to do things to help other people. But it's hard to do that when you can't meet your own needs. You know, when you can't meet your own needs of food and shelter, and, you know, you're just trying to survive, how the hell do you think about other people? And so our goal is to create a solution to that and say, okay, well, let's create an environment where you don't have to worry about those things, and a very specific path to helping other people. And now that you don't have to worry about those things and you've got an easy path to do something different, sweet, high five all around. Let's do it.
It's funny because it's so empowering, but people are conditioned to want to have possessions. So they worry about what they're going to lose, or, oh, well, if I have a community car, I might not get it when I need it, blah, blah, blah. And they start crying socialism and they get really scared. And that's just all a conditioned response. And it's so sad because this wouldn't be happening if it wasn't empowering and enriching the lives of other people. So for those very people to be afraid of what they're going to lose, how about you worry about what you'd gain from this?
Exactly. Yeah, well, and that's probably the switch that I think will be the difference between a generation raised with this idea versus those of us that have gotten to the point where we're at right now, which is that won't exist. you know, that idea, the focus will be constantly on the highest good of all, and the idea will be about constant expansion and that life is abundant and you don't have to worry about these things because they won't have, you know, decades of living in debt mm-hmm. as their experience that it's anything else. And they won't have decades mm-hmm. of watching the news and the horror stories. Instead, they'll be constantly focused on the positive and what they can get back and how they can contribute and all the good things. I mean, imagine the effects of that.
Yeah. Well, something I took away from Jacques Fresco that I really liked was, you know, people ask him, he says there'll be no police. And he's like, I think the best thing to solve crime would be to make sure everybody has everything they need. Because most crimes, like robberies and thefts, they come out of a necessity to feed themselves. And if everybody has that, there's not going to be that necessity. But also, there's something to lose. Like a lot of people who are on the street don't mind going to jail because now they have a house and food, which they don't have. But if you had your own house and food, you'd have something to lose to de-incentivize yourself from stealing, say, an iPhone or something of a higher level, because you don't want to lose everything you got. So we really do need to make sure people have food, clothing, and housing. And as a society, we should only think of ourselves as strong as our weakest link and make sure that everybody's got what they need so they don't have to resort to taking from one another.
Beautifully said. Totally agree. Yeah.
Something else I wanted to bring up. My good friend Kyle, who appears on the show a lot, he actually quit his job along with his wife about a year ago, and they really wanted to live in an off-the-grid community. But the ones they visited, they found a lot of issues with, whether it be the level of resources or the comfort or problems with the community's policies and hierarchy. They couldn't bring their dog or whatever.
Yep.
What is one community doing to make things comfortable and appealing for people that are fed up with our political and economic system, but also don't want to shit in a bucket and not have the internet? I mean, where's the middle ground?
Yeah. Well, so from a foundational standpoint, two things. Number one is really clearly defining exactly what it is that we're creating. You know, when you start talking about dogs and kids and childcare and all those kinds of things, there's a lot of, you know, individual issues, drug use, you name it. You know, right. Healthy living policy for one person could be an oppressive policy for another person. You know, so we've learned as an organization to really, really clearly identify exactly what it is that we're creating so that people that agree with those policies and want to be a part of it can. And equally as important is as a highest good of all organization to be really, really to be clear that we're non-ideological about it. Like we're just saying, hey, this is the party that we want to throw as one community. And we're an open source organization. Nothing would make us happier than to see somebody throw a different version of this party that looks completely
right.
different, you know, using everything that we have. Take it, use it, start from right where we are right now and start in a different direction, because we need as many of these successful models as we possibly can. And the more diversity that's out there, the more that benefits humanity as a whole. That really is positive. Even if it's a completely different mindset, maybe it doesn't have anything to do with world change. Maybe it's just a survivalist community, or who cares? It doesn't really matter. The idea is moving in this direction and creating self-sufficiency and self-sustainability on a grand scale is a really positive thing. And then the second part of your question was, you know, when you talk about internet and things like that, is really recognizing that for us as an organization, being not returning to the Stone Age and recognizing that the resources right. that we have as far as technology is concerned, and really, really sharing a lifestyle that the mainstream would generally agree is superior includes technology and these kinds of things. And so the business model that is one community, the for-profit and the nonprofit existence and the foundations that allow us to create what it is that we're creating will provide those things. And we think that's important that's a big part of the blueprints as well, and why we've already open sourced our complete nonprofit application, how we became a nonprofit organization. And we will be open sourcing, we're continuing to develop and open sourcing all of the for-profit aspects of one community too, so that people can duplicate this.
I think that philosophy is definitely the right one, because if you just look at what's been going on in the last couple of years, there's just, you know, there's a growing amount of distrust in centralized power, and, you know, large corporations are having a harder and harder time existing. And you start to see, you know, even corporations like Apple are starting to like lose their grip on technology and having this monopoly on, you know, smartphones and whatever. And the reason I bring that up is because I truly believe that we're going to see the paradigm of centralized power dispersing into the hands of local groups. And it seems like that's exactly what you're encouraging. And we're eventually going to get there through the growth of technology and the spreading of power anyway. And I really believe there needs to be some kind of guidelines for that type of future society where everything is going to be made locally. You know, you're going to have 3D printing and fabrication labs in every major city in the next 10 years, I truly believe. And we're not going to need the Apples of the world and the Exxon Mobils of the world to bring it together for us. We're going to need local communities that are motivated and have the right philosophy and the right guidelines.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and if we demonstrate as a better model, then I'd like to believe that the Apples of the world and you know, the Exxons of the world will get on board because it makes sense for their bottom line too, you know, until kind of the ridiculousness of the system as a whole is obvious. And it's like, hey, we can just let go of this. And, you know, we don't have to give up our mansions. We can just live in a happy populace on planet Earth and, you know, everything can run smoothly. We just got to get close enough to that to reach that tipping point.
Yeah. And let's look at the next 3 to 5 years. Let's say you got the funding today and you were going to hit the ground. You got this piece of property. How would the building start? When would you start bringing people in? What would the first test city, the model city, look like? I mean, I've heard you say tourism would be a big part of income generation, which is an awesome idea. But let's get into those details a bit.
Yeah. So if you really want to get into the details, you can read this stuff on the website. For instance, like our projections for the first Earthbag Village, we've got them broken down. If you wanted to do it with, you know, one team of 10, two teams of 10, three teams of 10, or what we're going to do is four teams of 10 working concurrently, you know, and the details of exactly how you choose leadership within those environments and how that works out for the first 2 years. I mean, it's an amazing amount of detail. So to kind of give an overview of what that looks like, if we were to get the funding today, the number one thing that would help us the most would be to get the property off the market. Getting the property off the market would allow us to expand our team exponentially, because right now everybody that's on this team is joined without having any idea of where the location was until they've got to their second interview and then going, okay. So there's a certain level of commitment just to join one community. If we could share the location and market those details, man, it would help us complete the team a lot faster. Then we're just working on everything to become shovel ready. If we could take the property off the market today, I believe that we could move on to the property come this coming spring. And then the time that it would take to build the first village model, which is maximally affordable sustainability, the Earthbag Village model, which is housing for 100 people, and it'll cost, not counting the energy infrastructure, it'll cost under $300,000 or $400,000. And so that the time to build that is about 2 years. And so that's pretty much how the whole thing would unfold. And then our goal is to become the number one provider of open source and free shared information in the world within 6 months. So concurrent with building the Earthbag Village, we'll also be building our food infrastructure, and all the details of how much time and how many labor hours are going to be contributed to that are all on the website, you know, and then running the social architecture aspect of it as well. And so based on our projections, we would land on the property with 50 people because we've got infrastructure on the property to support that. And then within 6 months, we would start bringing in our first people working as volunteers and on a scholarship program where we provide food, housing, and obviously the recreational environment while everybody helps to build and learns all of this technology. And so essentially those people would become the ambassadors to the next generation of communities because they would have the hands-on experience to be able to take that information out. And from that group, we would be selecting the next group of pioneers or the people to come on to one community and to grow the resonance of our organization so that we have the necessary labor force to build the second village, which is maximally expandable sustainability, so modular sustainability, and that's the straw bale village. You know, and so by year two, we would be ready to do that. We would have our food infrastructure in place, and there's details of how that food infrastructure rolls out on the website too. And we would be by the end of the first year, we would have enough units that we could actually start hosting our first tourists in where they would have a place to stay, as opposed to, hey, if you just want to come out, we've got an open weekend right now and we'll feed you and, you know, you can camp on the property and check out what we're doing. It's kind of like an open house. By the second year, we could actually start really hosting people where it's like, just come and visit and see this lifestyle, you know, and recognize that the lifestyle is building and growing every single day. And if you want to participate in that, here's the broad variety of different things that are happening on this property right now. And, you know, you can get your hands dirty with us if you're interested.
Man, it's so inspiring. From the what I've seen on the website, I really liked the housing models specifically. You've got 7 different building models for housing. They all seem to be, they seem to have taken inspiration from the 7 chakras, which is pretty awesome. It's a nice little subtext, but I really love the subterranean and the treehouse models.
Yeah.
I mean, how long before you're going to get into some of these other models of building, and what, how do they differ?
Well, you know, our really ambitious goal would be to be building the 7th village within 5 years. To do that, we have to hit all of our first village and second village model timelines, because that creates the infrastructure for us to have a sufficient revenue stream to expand indefinitely, and enough infrastructure for us to bring in the labor force that would need to be pretty huge to be able to pull that off. And once we do that, you know, we could operate with anywhere from, 300 full-time residents is our first benchmark that we're shooting for. And then another, 150 constant visitors. So 30% of the community is designed for visitors. The primary differences between the different models, as I already said, was the Earthbag Village would be the first one that we're building because it is maximally affordable. The second one is the Straw Bale Village model because it's maximally expandable. The idea on that one is that you could build several units. Say you could build a mini village model for a group of 20 people. And then as they went through the interview process and realized that they wanted to bring on another 5 or 10 people, they could just add additional units to the Straw Bale model that they have, which is like a, in our case, it's a torus or a circular model, but it could be designed as a more of a snake-like model. And as that snake-like model expanded, it actually creates a wind buffer for food production and growing an orchard and that kind of stuff. Then after that, we go into the Cobb Village, and then the Earth Block Village, then subterranean like Hobbin homes where you're growing, where you're building them totally underground with living roofs and things like that. Then yeah. Earthship, and then the tree houses are the last, just because permitting, and you know, we'll need to take everything that we learn in 1 through 6 to build number 7. You know, and so we've really put a lot of thought into, okay, how are we rolling this out? You know, the Earth Bag is really, really simple. You know, Straw Bale is a big step up from that, from complexity standpoint, but not such a big step as far as permitting and engineering and that kind of stuff goes. Same thing with the Cobb Village model, which will use all the remaining straw and everything from the Straw Bale Village, you know, and then we start getting into Earth Block. And from that point on, now you're getting into way more complex models, but we'll have the established relationship with, which we already have, but we'll have, you know, really have the nuts and bolts of working with the county and what to expect from them and how to make them happy and how to make everybody's life as easy and as smooth as possible to keep moving forward, and the revenue streams to support it all, so that if we make mistakes, we can afford to go, okay, we made a mistake, let's fix that, you know, let's do it differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure, did that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Speaking of which, from a level of more of a sociological standpoint, we've been talking a lot about logistical stuff, but it seems like what always crops up within civilizations of any size when they're around long enough is some sort of discord or instability. Like, I would imagine there's got to be somebody in kind of a leadership role, which inevitably kind of creates an opposite side of the coin of people who disagree with where the leader wants to take them. And I know you guys are really all about having open source communities, so you can create your own town or place of dwelling if you choose to. But how would you deal with that in your society if there was some kind of dissension?
Yeah, so the model as a whole, so the governing system, which also you can read about on the website, is modeled after Jack Reed's book, The Next Evolution, which talks about consensus for groups of 200 plus. And it's real different from what you would see, say, in consensus for the Occupy movement or something like that.
Good.
And so first and foremost, you know, there's a screening process of a consciousness for the highest good of all, you know, because it only takes one person in a consensus organization that has an agenda, you know, and isn't really thinking big picture and is only thinking about individual wants and needs to really change that environment, you know, to make it very difficult to get anything done. True. You know, and so we really clearly, we have an organization culture of focusing on what is for the highest good of all, and we really demonstrate that. And every decision that we make it becomes pretty obvious when we just take ourselves out of the equation and just ask what really is the best for humanity. And so by maintaining that culture, that's kind of the first way of addressing that. And then the second way is maintaining a consensus organization where we have groups that work together, and then they come together so that every voice is heard in small groups, and then representatives of those groups come to another group and everything rotates. And you can see the details of how that works on the website. And so that's what we're, you know, we have trainings and things like that that are a big part of our screening process and a part of our educational process. So every person on the property is trained in this. And then in addition to that, part of the big culture is part of our education model that's built into this. And we're modeling that off of the four agreements. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with four, I'm guessing you are, the four agreements and Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth, you know. And so we really, as a group, and this is just our culture, it's not something that, you know, we're ideological about or pushing on other people. But from our group, we really see embracing consciousness and this concept of transcending the ego and really looking at our place in the bigger picture and how we can help humanity and how we can best cooperate and collaborate as a foundational culture and as a way of life, and holding each other specifically accountable to that. So that the idea is that, you know, we can really, really communicate about the things as they come up and avoid it becoming what I feel you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Something else I wanted to ask you about, I mean, we've covered housing, of course, you know, food production is going to be a huge thing, hydroponics and aquaponics, I'm sure you're going to be using. But You talked about on the website this central hub, this community center, this three-domed building in the middle. Tell us about that a little bit. What would go on there?
Yeah, so that's the Sago Center City Hub. And what it is it's a duplicable recreation center that replaces it. I guess an easy way to describe that is that would be the epitome of a resource-based economy, in my opinion. And the idea is that by putting your resources into a central hub where it hosts your dining facilities, it has laundry for 300 people, it has a recreational space where, you know, 200 people could gather at one time. By putting your resources into that instead of individual spaces in people's homes, it saves a ridiculous amount of money, and it creates a space that most people would consider opulent. I mean, really, just like, oh my God, this is amazingly beautiful. And it's like, well, yeah, that costs about the cost of a couple homes, you know, but the difference is it saved us building all of these individual kitchens and all of these individual laundry rooms and all of these individual. So the idea of the duplicable city hub is twofold. Number one, to create a LEED Platinum certified building that can be built anywhere in the world and can function as a revenue stream. If people wanted to invest a sizable amount of money and basically live in a really beautiful space and then build a village model around it, the Sago Center duplicable city hub is a way to do that. It's basically saying, hey, you could put up a bunch of money, you could pay somebody to build this for you in Haiti, and then you could move there and you could build your village model around that and expand and create an entire sustainable city around that. And you would never have to do what everybody that's a part of our organization has to do, which is, you know, living in, you know, shared accommodations with very little space and, you know, building from scratch. So that's the first purpose of that. The second purpose of that, which is equal or maybe even more important, is that idea of saving resources. And so in the case of one community, the living arrangements that we have, the city model that we've designed is more of a, it's more of like a, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, there's small living arrangements, small living accommodations, more like hotel rooms, because the social spaces and the common spaces are where we put our resources. So the idea is that in the environment, the social environment that we're creating, you're not spending time sitting in your living room watching TV. You're constantly proactive. And so we're redefining what a person's home looks like. What is the purpose of that? What is really your private space? You know, and for anybody that lives in a large family, it's your bedroom. And so when we looked at it, we just said, okay, well, what if we really built it more like that and said, okay, why don't we just create these homes to be really small, you know, 200 square foot private spaces that are really purposed for sleeping and intimacy and maybe reading a book or something, and then put all of our resources into really beautiful spaces that are common spaces that can also be, you know, big social spaces or private spaces if people want to get away. And that's why those spaces are built into our food infrastructure and everything else that we're doing. We're always saying, okay, how can we create a place where if somebody just wanted to get away from it, this would be the place to go. and it would be so much more beautiful than sitting in even the nicest living room you can imagine. Let's create that, because it's a 15-minute walk through the forest anyway, so why don't we do that instead? It just makes more sense, and in the process, it saves massive amounts of resources.
Yeah, man, it's so inspiring. It sounds great. Walk us through the energy infrastructure. We haven't talked much about that. I assume solar, geothermal, wind?
Yeah, so initially, you know, originally we were looking at a whole bunch of a diversity of different things, and then we ended up settling after a lot of consulting and talk about it on solar. And so we're starting with solar. We've got a couple partners that have some really revolutionary energy ideas. But as most people know, you know, I got to see that proven before I'm going to get super excited about it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of skeptical and simultaneously extremely hopeful. You know, so for our energy infrastructure, we started with tried and true. And from that point, we will have, like I said, once our initial infrastructure is set up and the energy infrastructure is part of that, we'll have the revenue that we need to explore other options and expand as much as we want to with geothermal and looking at wind and then some of these other emerging technologies that I personally haven't seen proven yet in a way where it's like, okay, I'm going to invest in that. That's what we're going to do. But we have a lot of these organizations that are contacting us and saying, hey, when you guys, we want to come out, you know, we want to demonstrate this at one community. And so we're super open to that. If you can prove it, we just don't have the team to effectively evaluate those things right now. And so we're sticking with tried and true. And when we're on the property, we have 50 people to look at this technology and have somebody come out and show it to us. Then we can make a decision if we want to expand in other ways if they're proven.
That sounds great. Something else I wanted to ask you, because I know you've been looking at building materials and all these things for many years. And yep. I noticed there's also a couple building organizations partnered with you on this. And,
yep.
You know, something I'm interested in my own life is trying to improve my financial situation. I'm sure a lot of the listeners are also paying rent like I am. It's a huge waste of money. And I stress over when I'll ever be able to own a home in this type of economic situation. It seems far outside of my means right now. But,
yeah.
You know, if I bought an acre of land and wanted to build a house myself that was cheap, efficient, structurally sound, a comfortable place to live, but probably using unconventional materials, with all the knowledge you've gained, how would you advise someone to do something like that?
Well, where we stand right now, without what we're creating, you'd probably need to circumvent the system, you know, and that's a big part of what we're trying to solve.
Right.
Is, hey, you know, here's permitted blueprints, and that's what we're working on. If you don't want to permit things, you don't mind the distinct possibility that you might have to tear it all down or have it bulldozed, then there's a broad diversity of different things out there that you can do with tiny homes, earth bag homes, cob, all these things. I mean, you could build a home, a very nice home for $15,000 or $20,000. The tricky part about it is as an individual, you're probably going to run into problems with the county. And what most people run into is they're so afraid to even start the process, because
right.
If you get told no, then you're dead in the water and now they're looking at you. And so that's what we want to fix. You know, like we want to show, hey, here's a county that said it works. It's permitted and everything, you know, engineering and everything that's necessary is right here. Now take this with confidence in before you buy a piece of land and talk to your county and say, I want to build something like this. Are you guys hip to this idea? Here it's been done. Here's the full blueprints and the spread. This is what I'm thinking. And then you'll know ahead of time whether or not you can do that. And then people can make those decisions with confidence and start spreading these ideas.
Touche. Yeah, that does seem to be the challenge, is there's just so much regulation, you know, under the guise of safety, and I'm sure some of it is safety, but it also limits your ability to take care of your own damn self. You know, it's so frustrating. Yep. I think about maybe moving to a lesser established place, a more tropical, isolated area, but that comes with a whole host of other problems. It just seems like a lose-lose, but you guys are doing a pretty good job of trying to integrate those things and participate and also transcend, which is really inspiring.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the key that we see as getting this model to spread very quickly, is the idea that, you know, once the blueprints and everything are set up, well, that you kind of answered your own question. If you're okay not living in the United States and you want to live sustainably, then there's a lot of different ideas out there that you could take and you could go and live in another country and you could build without without permits and see what you could do. But I think the majority of people probably want to stay close to their families and things like that. And so we really want to address that. But then once the city models and the village models are completely designed, now we've created an option where a person can take their family and friends with them and go build in another country. And that addresses the bulk of the issues that most people would have for moving out of the country and really establishing themselves somewhere else, where this would be considerably easier. You know, and we're working on establishing the relationships with the providers of technology and the providers of materials and things like that, so we can streamline the process as much as possible for people who want to build anywhere on the planet.
Let me ask you about your process of getting people involved with this first community. I mean, are there paid positions that you have at this stage of the game? I mean, are there ways for people, if people are motivated to walk away from their day job, can they come to you and say, hey, I've got $5,000 in assets I will put towards the purchase of this property? Like, what's your process for really getting that first stage going?
Yep, we're 100% group of unpaid volunteers, so self-included. Right now I'm funding this whole thing myself, and from a fairness point, it doesn't cost anything to join one community. It's just an investment of time and energy. And in the example that you were talking about, one community is designed to be a solution to exactly what you're asking for, which is if somebody applies to be a part of one community and they move onto the property and they work for 18 months and helping us build and create one community, at the end of 18 months, you would own the home that you helped build. And then at that point, those people could either sell that home, which will appreciate as the community continues to expand and improve itself, or they could live in that home, obviously, and stay with one community. And as they do that, they would upgrade that home as we build the second village model, the third village model, et cetera. Or they could travel the world or go buy a house somewhere else and maintain that home and we would maintain that home as an income property for the individual. So in the short term, how we're gathering people right now is we're just saying, hey, this is what we're doing. If you want to be a part of world change, it doesn't cost any money. And we've had people who said, hey, I have money, I'd like to contribute it. And we're not actually even open to that, because a $30,000, even a $30,000 or $100,000 or a $200,000 contribution to our project doesn't really change anything. You know, we're looking for somebody to buy the property and to be fully funded. And so from a fairness standpoint, we're really looking for outside revenue so that everybody is equally invested in their time and their energy, and there's no hierarchy, And so that's my perspective as the person who's funding it right now. I'm not attached to any of that. And so we can keep our intent and our goals pure and focused on highest good of all thinking. And so that's another reason why, one community, we have the model is designed so that nobody should ever have to pay to become a part of one community. It's just an investment of time and energy. And then that's the great equalizer. And this comes back to the resource-based economy, is if we make time our only currency, and now it's not a matter of, well, you have this education, whatever. That's really what we want to focus on. It's like, okay, we're all equal here and we're all contributing because we believe in what we're creating. And then now it's totally fair, I guess, is the easiest way to describe it.
We touched on this a bit, but on the subject of technology that we were talking about before, and how it seems to me that you guys are kind of embracing like an older tribal style of living in smaller communities, but you're trying to include technology into that equation. But in the long term, do you see any equation or any technologies that are on the horizon that are really going to help this movement and really going to help it spread at all?
Yeah, we have that touches on it. We actually dedicated a page on our website to this idea, because when you really start thinking about the options for technology, for instance, most people know that iPads are not really created super ethically. Going on, how Apple's products are created is really not ideal, and yet they provide, in a lot of people's opinions, a superior product that provides what we need to function. And so we started as a group, we've talked about this, and we've said, how do we create a way to influence Apple to produce a better product? Or how do we create an engine for the global collaborative to work together to create technological solutions to a lot of these different things that we really don't have the time and energy to focus on right now? And so our approach to that is the highest good of all philosophy. We basically made a list of things where we just said, okay, these are areas, this will be a growing list of areas where we know that we would like a better solution. And we've already got the global population saying, hey, have you thought about this or what about this? And it's like, man, that's a great idea, but we're stretched thin. You know, our plate is already full. And so we've created this, we're creating the infrastructure to basically address those questions. And then almost it's like, I think the best analogy would be like crowdfunding a crowd thought process. So instead of a monetary crowdfunding process, it's more an idea of building momentum of people saying, hey, these are issues that are interesting and important to us. And here's the global collaborative thought process on solutions. And if we had a company that wanted to take this solution and run with it, we can build a market for that so that then the company could crowdfund that or whatever it is. And so the idea is, what if we took this concept and we created the, like I said, the mind trust, a global mind trust, where we go, hey, as one community, we're highest good for all organization, and we know that this is not ideal. So we're putting it out to the world population to say, what are your ideas on how to fix this? And we would love the global collaborative to work on this issue. And if there's any companies that would like to address this issue specifically, we are interested in talking to you because we're creating an engine for promoting this idea. If you can do it for the highest good of all globally. And by doing that, we believe that we can influence, you know, just the same way that Walmart has arguably influenced it in a negative way. We believe that we can really influence it in a very empowering and super positive way and get Walmart on board in the process because it benefits them too.
And that kind of ties it all together then, because you have the local communities, but then you have this kind of global online think tank that keeps the dialogue going among all these different communities. And I feel like that's really the missing piece that you had in the past, rather than having all these isolated communities that kind of viewed all these other societies as outside of them. Like, there's really something tying them together then.
Yep. And we're even in the process of developing software to facilitate that process. And you can read about that. It's called the ACE app on our website as well for coordinating those decisions. And then also really gaining objective data on everything from the social architecture and how people utilize their time as a sociological experiment, as well as, you know, exactly what the materials were used to build this, exactly what the tools were used to build the Earthbag Village, exactly how many labor hours went into that. Because we see the gathering of that data and then sharing that with the global collaborative. And as more and more communities pop up that are interested in collaborating on this thing, because the idea is that, hey, your needs are met now. You, now that your needs are met, you have an opportunity to take your free time and apply it to helping more and more people. And it doesn't take everybody doing that to create a global shift, to really create a global network. And the idea is to spread that network and make it bigger and bigger and bigger. And then more information is being fed in. Our lobbying, our buying power, all of those details go up. And then, you know, the natural shift of the market will be guided because we really are demonstrating a new paradigm that is better. And we're not fighting against anybody. We're not, you know, it's all positive and forward thinking.
Man, you've definitely done your homework and a lot of research, and I do appreciate you sharing all that with us. It's about time we wrap this up. It has been great talking to you. Is there anything else you want to leave the people with? Maybe your website?
Yeah, our website is onecommunityglobal.org. And I guess the closing thought is what we're doing is open to everybody. You know, there's lots of ways to participate in what we're creating. We can use, you know, there's just, if you have talent in any area and you're interested in what we're doing, get involved in what we're doing. And if there's any aspect of our project that is helpful or useful to any other project, or if somebody's been thinking about something like this and would like to take it in a completely different direction, copy our entire website and start from there. Take everything we have or whatever pieces work for you, and there's your foundation. We've got thousands and thousands of hours of work that's done, and we're giving it away, and there's no greater compliment than to see it taken and used. You don't have to credit one community. You just use it. Use it. Let's spread these ideas and get it out there.
Powerful. Well, Jay, thanks again. That was awesome.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, man.
All right, man. Good luck and have a good day.
Thank you. You guys too.
Peace.
See ya.
You know, Michael Nelson, my man, how did you like that? You know, what's on your mind now?
Oh, it was really cool. It was really cool. I like that. Like I said, I just really like that these guys are actually, you know, bringing it down to earth and doing something on a local level. And you know, and having that internet infrastructure in order to mobilize a larger movement. I think that's where it's lost. I feel like either people are doing something locally or they're doing something online and talking a big game, but it's almost like never the twain shall meet, you know. It's like one or the other, but the new paradigm is definitely in having that, you know, harmony between those two aspects, I think.
Yeah, you know, Jacques Fresco is 97, 98 years old, and when people approach him with questions about small cities and stuff like that, he almost says, look, if we can't get this thing running for maximum efficiency with maximum global energy infrastructure, it's not going to work. And it's like, I see your point, but dude, you're 98 years old. You've been doing this your whole goddamn life. Don't you want to live in an area yourself with a community of people that at least have your ideals in mind, that you can kind of maybe within your little world feel like it's everywhere? I mean, Jesus Christ, you're going to die soon. And you're just talking, you know, you're talking a lot about it, doing a lot of interviews. And I don't know, I wish there was more happening. So I'm glad Jay in One Community is doing that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think I couldn't agree with you more that I think the change is definitely going to have to start locally, and maybe like-minded people from different parts of the country kind of doing the same thing on their own is really what it's going to take. I mean, it's nice to sit here and talk conjecture about stuff like Hyperloop and like all these huge scale projects that are going to cost billions and billions of dollars. But I really think before we get funding for anything crazy like that, we're going to need to start demonstrating things on a local level with local money and local work.
I think it's just more about breaking people out of that mindset. You know, they can they can watch the Venus Project documentary, but they just have all these negative things to say about it. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? How are you going to do this? You know, am I going to be able to watch Breaking Bad and get wasted at Dave and Buster's within this society? I don't think so. You know,
that
can I have an iPhone?
Concern.
Am I only going to be able to wear one type of shoe? You know, people are, they worry too much about that shit. And if they could see it, you know, that's why you need that test city. You see it, and then as the population of that city grows, it just expands outward until it is the whole fucking state of Montana.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be awesome. But, you know, what's, before we go, man, what's new for you? What's next with Midwest Reel? How's that going?
It's going pretty well, man. I've been really busy with my band, actually. We recorded over the summer, so I've been focusing a lot of my energy on that. And we just finished recording, and that's going to be coming out on a label out of St. Louis.
Oh, that's my hometown.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
What label?
They're a new label. They're called Easy Killer.
It's
run by a guy who used to be he played music in bands, and he's been a promoter for years and booked shows for years. His name is Mike Judy. He's about our age. He's a really good guy.
I know.
What's
the name of the band?
City of Ghosts.
Cool.
It's kind of like a progressive indie rock heavy thing. I don't know. That's always a hard question to try to answer. Like, what type of music is it? But
yeah.
That's kind of what I always say.
Nice, man. And as far as the podcast world's concerned, man, it is a crazy place, and I'm glad that it's connected the both of us.
Yeah, sure.
This has been fun. I appreciated being on Midwest Reel. You know,
me too, man.
I started my show because the people that I wanted to hear from, the topics I wanted to know about, they weren't getting a fair shake, or they had to appear on shows with a certain slant that I didn't like. And now people are asking me to come on their shows, and it's really come full circle. It's a little off-putting. Even though I did recently get kicked off a couple of podcast networks because of the Sandy Hook episode and the complaints they got, but, you know, that's part of what we're doing. You know, I'm talking about things people aren't talking about, and it sometimes it's extremely depressing, and, you know, sometimes it's inspiring, like today.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's what I really like doing, more positive subjects, because I get in that same little loop on my show where it just kind of seems like we're headed for some kind of disaster, some kind of breakdown, and it's inevitable. But I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that there's routes we can definitely go that are going to be small steps that will eventually lead to some kind of systemic change that's significant, you know?
Agreed. Well, I mean, on that note, you know, I loved having you here.
Stay in touch, man.
Best of luck with everything you're doing.
Thanks so much. And if people do want to check it out, check out MidwestReel.net. That's where we post all of our podcasts and articles that we write. Follow us on Twitter at MidwestReel. Like us on Facebook. It's just facebook.com/MidwestReel. So yeah, that's about it.
Right on. Cool, man. I appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you again.
You too, brother. Take care.
All right.
Children will play.